Bill Nash did his national service in British administrated Palestine after the Second World War. More recently, he served in the colonial office in Hong Kong before he returned to China. So with that short introduction, I'd like to bring Bill in and to discuss with Bill about that time he spent in Palestine after the Second World War and during the beginning of the Israeli settlements.
Good evening, Bill, and thanks for joining us at Unity FM 93.5.
Good evening. Good evening.
Now, it's, we've just heard the introduction, Bill, and it's, you sound like you're, you know, it's been a fascinating intro that what we read about you, the time in Palestine and the recent timing with the British colonial China and Hong Kong. I'd like to start talking to you by your time in Palestine during the the beginning of the trouble of the Palestine-Israel.
The last days of the mandate.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Yes. Well, I was called up in 1945, end of the war, and in 1946, after King David had been blown up, I arrived in Jerusalem. Beautiful climate, beautiful place. I lived in Allenby Barracks, and most of the survivors of the explosion in the hotel, which killed, I think, about a quarter of the people, one of the complete wings was blown down. The survivors were there, and I had a very nice time in Jerusalem. Later on, I was stationed down in the plains in the heat, where it was more or less just a bit of sand and barbed wire, and no fraternizing, I'm afraid, with the local population because of the terrorist organizations which were doing their best to take over Palestine and make it Israel.
And
I was there right until the last troops left from Haifa. After we handed over to the United Nations, I think it was 1948, if my memory is certainly right, we kept a brigade in Haifa, ostensibly to get our stores out of there, and the rest of the mandate was handed over to the United Nations, and the fighting started. And lasted for quite a while. But we left after about a month or 6 weeks, once we knew that the matter was resolved. We could not leave, I don't think, until we knew that the Israelis would or the Jews would survive, having had the dreadful Holocaust in Europe the year before and war ended there. We couldn't abandon them, really. Though we had no right to stay on, but we did.
More recently, there's... yes, sorry.
People are writing a lot about it at the moment, emphasizing all the sort of the killings and so on and so forth. It was quite a holiday there, really. It was a lovely climate, and it was boring because we had no girls, no social life. We were in camps surrounded by mines. We stayed there because the troubles sometimes outside, but it was very seldom anything happened. We had 100,000 soldiers there, four divisions, but only there because we were waiting to run down the army after the Second World War. We had soldiers in.
Now, this Walter. Is rather interesting because just recently there's been a dramatized series running on Channel 4,
yes.
Which is called The Promise.
Yes.
And certainly from what you're saying, it does seem there's been some incredible inaccuracies in that drama.
Some dreadful...
Yeah, inaccuracies.
Oh, yes. Well, of course, you've got to dramatize things. I mean, you don't deal with the boring stuff. I mean, you never knew if you were going to be blown up if you were driving an army vehicle along a road, but it was so unlikely. And, of course, there was quite a bit of civilian traffic, so they had to be very careful. Not easy. And... but it wasn't something that people worried much about. The drama of Nathania, where they strangled, they didn't hang the two sergeants, they captured two sergeants and hung them from a tree. They were strangled, really. They were just drawn up and allowed to strangle and die there. It was in the place where I was stationed, and there had been trouble, and we'd been confined to camp for several months, and then they said, right, tomorrow night's been quiet. You can go out and go out town and mingle with the people and have dinner and that sort of thing. So we thought, we won't go out tonight, we'll go out tomorrow night. And and make a big night of it. And that night, the two sergeants were taken. So we were confined to camp again. We searched for them for quite a while, but we missed them. And then we found them in an orchard hung. In order to... I drove through the village next day of Nathania. there were only men on the streets. All the women and children had been evacuated because there was something like this had happened under the Germans, and there was a dreadful reaction. And as soon as it was discovered, the brigade was sent to Transjordan, which was Jordan now, for exercises in the desert for 3 months without being cooled off. Not one person was touched.
And was this attack, was the hanging actually carried out by members of the Stern Gang?
I think it's probably the Stern Gang, yes, they were the worst, yeah.
So, again, I'm looking at this drama, and of course in this drama it seems that, you know, the whole camp is kind of conspiring with the Stern Gang against the British soldiers, and of course they were jamming radios, they were putting propaganda over the radios, there was a very anti-British feeling.
I never felt, funnily enough, I never felt, because the Jews kept their heads down, as I would have done if I'd been through the war, and I was sitting there with my family and hoping to sort of...
Yes, of course.
A nice life. I wouldn't keep put my head out of the parapet. People are going to start shooting British soldiers. I'm going to keep out of it. But there was never any feeling of anti-British. I never found that myself at all. And it was very isolated. I had a platoon sergeant killed. That was all. There was never any feeling about it. There was never any really sense of danger all the time. And I love the climate there, it was wonderful.
Keeping on the subject of this Stern Gang, of course,
yes.
They were, of course, trained and they fought in World War II for the Allies. Do you think they were justified in any way?
I think it seemed to me a never-ending danger.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Jews and the Arabs had lived in that place for a couple of thousand years. And suddenly, for one side or the other, say, well, we're going to take this over and run this as a Jewish state or an Arab state and so on, bound to cause trouble. Because Britain had a mandate from the United Nations to keep the peace, but we had a very difficult problem because we handed over all the oil fields to the Arab states, and we needed oil badly. We didn't want to get on the wrong side of the Arabs. At the same time, we had a responsibility to Jews. No one would forgive us if we let them down, having had this dreadful Holocaust and the Second World War. So we had a very fine dividing line there, and the Stern Gang took advantage of it, of course, and they pressed and pressed, and I think it was a bad mistake to do it, because it always comes back on you. I mean, they've had this sort of thing being done to them, happened to them for 40, 50 years now. It's all very sad.
It is indeed very sad. They spent a considerable amount of time out there. And of course, you're there up until, of course, the Declaration of Independence. Are there any memorable things that you could relate to us on the show today that really stand out from your time there?
Yes, I was in Jerusalem, and I'd been down to the Officers' Club in Jerusalem itself. I was in Allenby Barracks, where I stationed. And the beautiful Jewish girl, receptionist at the Officers' Club. So I found out that I was entitled to live there. I arranged to move in at the end of the week on the Friday, I think it was. And unfortunately, on the Thursday, it was blown up by one of the terrorist organizations. And so I didn't move in because it was destroyed. And I was on the Court of Inquiry, three officers. I was one of the junior officer. And on to investigation as to how and why it happened. And there was a photograph there in that inquiry of two British soldiers, coming out of the entrance to the Officers' Club with a stretcher, and the woman's body on the stretcher was this very receptionist, this beautiful girl, with her head on the side of the stretcher, burn her head straight off. One soldier leaned to one side to vomit. Dramatic. Dramatic. Don't think that's ever been publicized.
Did you see many scenes like this in your time in Palestine?
A big one.
Did you see many scenes similar to this?
No.
This was a one-off, really.
Yes. The Officers' Club, and it was a good target, wasn't it? It was a great pity. It was a lovely place. very interesting, the survivors. Some people were sunbathing on the roof and just went down with the building and walked off in their bathing costumes and towels. Others were killed. It was very interesting who was killed and who wasn't, where you were, and the force of the explosion, etc. But as I said, I had a platoon sergeant killed, but he was, we were allowed out into Haifa one night, and he went out in a government vehicle, and we blew him up down the road. We didn't find him until the next day. But it was, that was a rarity. That was a rarity. But there was always the danger there. But I mean, most of the time, the British Army, I mean, we had soldiers in Gibraltar, we had soldiers in Tripolitania, we had soldiers in Cyprus, in Suez, in Egypt, in the Canal Zone, in Pakistan, in India, in Ceylon, Hong Kong, Singapore, everywhere. This was just a minor thing. Very little it was reported in the press because we had soldiers being killed. I mean, in Germany, in the Army of Occupation, on an exercise, it was not unusual to lose 20 officers and men on an exercise. These accidents happen. But we're making a lot of it today because there's very little going on. And it's highly political now.
Yes. Did you ever get a chance to speak to meet the Palestinians? And
Yes, of course, of course. But one would have to be very careful. People were very nice and friendly to me. And they were interested to talk to one, you know. Most of them would come from Europe and they were very interested to talk to fellow Europeans. And but they had to be careful, of course, otherwise they might get picked on. I felt no feeling about it at all. None of our soldiers felt about it badly at all. It was part of course.
Yes. What was the sentiment like there, you know, in terms of, you know, how the Palestinians felt? Did you sense a sense of, you know, of discontent? Or
no, not really, no. They were going to make a lovely country of it. They had already sort of orange groves springing up and green and everything. And that, I mean, these people had been through a war. We had you said an interesting case. One of the most interesting cases was we were sent down with battalion on a shoreline where a ship was coming in from Europe with refugees on it, which we were had to turn back always. It was our duty to do that. As they came ashore, we had to collect them, herd them all together, and get them, put them on another boat to send them off to Cyprus to a detention camp there before they returned to Europe. And we had them all there, and they were being put into some buildings at the end of the beach. And there was a commotion starting. And the commanding officer sent an interpreter down to find out what was going on. And he came back and said that they were frightened because the building had, in Hebrew, above the doorway, oven. It was an old bakery, and they thought they were going to be burned.
And that was the Jewish refugees that actually went to Israel from Europe.
Yes, they were doing it all the time. Yes, some got through. If we caught them, they couldn't. But all those people on that beach were let go, allowed to stay. See, I just sent the troops away.
In the promise, you see, of course, one soldier actually letting a refugee through late at night. And there was, of course, a quota that was, you know.
Our duty was by the League of Nations, which is pre United Nations, the League of Nations, that was our mandate.
Mm-hmm.
And when our mandate finished, the United Nations took over, and that's when the fighting started. But all those people on that beach, we just had to let them go. Humanity.
Bring it a little bit forward now. Do you still pay attention to the current state of Palestine and Israel? And what do you think of it in contrast of today and back then?
Well, it's an insoluble problem. As long as there are forces behind preventing it happening, of course, the United States has the influence. Now, after Suez, we lost the influence in the Middle East, and the Americans now have been handling the Middle East themselves and learning on the hoof. And it's been quite a disaster, but there we are. It's a thing that will go on until one side solves the other. I mean, it's either one side wipes one out or one side wipes the other out. If people are insisting upon fighting, well, then in the end it's going to happen. We just must hope we don't get all drawn into it.
Do you think the promise overall, this dramatized series, and from what I see it seemed pretty accurate, but do you think it was overall a good portrayal of life back then?
No, of course it was dramatized. There were all sorts of things going on. I mean, there were certain people closer to the whole thing who were in the intelligence side, and of course the Palestine police were bearing the brunt of all this. They had to actually deal with it. The army was really kept in out of it. Really, we were just shot at because we're good targets, but we were kept very much out of it.
Yes.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, we've had the ongoing situation in Palestine, as you know, Bill. The current unrest that is going on in the Middle East at the moment, with all the uprising, I mean, we've seen the uprising in Egypt recently, Tunisia, we're seeing one in Libya.
Yeah.
Do you think that would actually influence the Palestine and could start a similar sort of revolution back there as well? How likely and the possibility of that happening?
It's very difficult to say. I don't think anybody can really forecast, because we don't know what elements are going to take over power from the present power groups. The tendency for the army, because they're always organized, to take over power immediately. I think they are in Egypt, and they promised only to do it for 6 months. There'll be a new power group come in. But I think it's very difficult to run countries now, even a democracy like our own here. In places, China isn't going to be an interesting case, because there's been no public opinion in these places. And China's had no public opinion. But now you've got the computer with emails, you've got the mobile telephone, and you've got television. People are beginning to know and understand what's going on, and how badly their countries run, and how they're being corrupt people are taking all their money. And this is very interesting development, and it's certain ways exciting, but I don't think anybody can really forecast how it's going to go. We all hope it will be nice and democratic and everybody will be happy after, but there are certain powerful forces, the extremists on both sides, the political sector will be looking there. I mean, there's a lot of money now in these places, some of these places with oil and so on and so forth.
Yes, of course.
Israel will be watching very, very carefully and watching very hopefully that it'll be turn out for the better, but they have no idea whether it will or not. Because they had a good relationship with Egypt, a safe and a sort of quiet one, and it's been lasting for some time, but whether there'll be balanced people to come in and maintain the presence situation, we don't know. But I think it's a very worrying time for some people, and it hasn't finished yet, and it's going to go on. Live in interesting times.
Yes, interesting times. Yes, indeed. Just as a kind of a wind-up question, I mean, I don't know if you did meet any kind of significant political figures out there, but if you did, who really stood out to you as somebody who could really possibly brought about peace in any shape or form?
Well, I was too young. I was just a young 18, 19 year old, so I didn't really know much about the world and personalities, and I wouldn't have had the slightest idea who was going to be powerful and who wasn't. So I had no idea about the future. One was not just beginning to form one's ideas in the world. And I couldn't say at that time what was going to happen. I knew it was going to be difficult, but we had to stay, I think, until we knew that the Israelis would survive. For how long? That was the United Nations problem. We couldn't leave and have them wiped out, because the Holocaust just happened. We could be blamed as being irresponsible. Unjustifiably, you might say, but it was our responsibility there anyway. As a matter of humanity, to see that there was a survival.
You mentioned, of course, the Holocaust, and at the beginning of that drama, they actually show some terrible, terrible scenes of the inhumane torture of the Holocaust victims.
Yes. Because, you see, it's an awful job to have these people escaping from Europe on the most appalling conditions in some of these boats and getting there, or clinging on the hope to get to the land that once they've hit, and here the British stolidly taking them back and putting them into a detention camp in Cyprus while they reloaded them onto ships and sent them back to Europe. Terrible job we had to do, which I think is why we they didn't volunteer to carry on too long doing it.
Did those people in Cyprus, did they ever get a chance to return in the end, or was that just it?
I think a lot of them came back, yes. They were determined, having had that dreadful experience in Europe, never again.
Mm.
And this is really a last question now, but, you know, considering what they went through, do you think this has become a mindset now? Do you think this is... In one part of the drama, that mentions that there's the grandfather of the young lady who's doing her duty in the IDF, and he mentions his reasons for being a member of the Stern Gang. And this is the very reason he gives, that feeling of that we'll never let it happen again. Do you think that feeling is permeating today a lot of Israeli society, and that it affects the policies that are taking place there?
They have no alternative. I think that in an answer to a question, the Prime Minister, I don't know who it was, about 10 years ago, said, look, the situation is this. If you disarm the Arabs, there'll be peace. If you disarm the Israelis, there'll be no Israel.
Do you think that's likely, though? I mean, surely if Israel was disarmed, I mean, surely do you believe that the Israeli state will actually will no longer exist?
Well, I'm sure that it's going to do a damn good try at surviving, and it's still here now after 50 or 60 years.
Absolutely.
We don't know what's going to happen to the Middle Islam in the Middle East. I mean, how is all this eruption is going to affect?
Mm.
there's some major strides got to be made in the Middle East. I mean, these countries now are becoming very, very rich, powerful countries with the oil situation.
Mm.
And there's no question about it. The power and the money, where the money goes, the power goes, and the money is going eastward. To the Middle East for oil, and the Far East because of the booming economies of Singapore, Hong Kong, China now, and India.
Mm.
And it's going to be a very different world. And I think we still think back in the West here that we're the rest of the world owes a living. I'm afraid they don't. And we've got a lot of lessons to learn, and we're going into a hard time because all these debts in Europe and America and so on, they're not being paid off yet. We're just trying to cut back on the expansion of spending instead of cutting back on the spending and living within our means. It's a great, great big question mark what's going to happen now. But I think the West, the time has passed.
Do you think things could have been... This is definitely... We really thank you for giving us your time. But, you know, do you think things could have been different if perhaps the policies had been different back in the two world wars, if perhaps, you know, the colonial policies that were practiced at the time were more in line with actually trying to, you know, be peaceful with trades rather than, you know, colonialism and, you know, other alternatives?
Yes, well, colonialism was a natural development. I mean, one went to new parts of the world because they'd never been seen or occupied, and one went there and one... I mean, India wasn't India. People say the British took over India, then abandoned it. But India wasn't India. It was a series of warring tribes. It was a huge continent of warring tribes.
Yes.
And it was amazing that this little country here sent people out and managed to sort of tame the whole thing, and with a handful of civil servants, with about 20,000 soldiers, ruled over that great continent. And I think, inadvertently, what has happened in India is that the Indians now will really benefit from this, because what they have in India is a democratic system in the sense that, all right, how corrupt and inefficient, blah, 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 but it does manage to hand over power from one party to the next without a revolution. You have the various parties have an election, and one party wins, and that party runs the government. Now, however badly or well is irrelevant. But they have that, and they also have a certain rule of law which we left behind. They understand
yes.
the rule of law, and they do operate it, however inefficiently or however well is irrelevant. Now,
yes.
China does not have that.
Unfortunately,
China's never been occupied as a complete country, a Japanese tribe for a while, but they do not have the system of the rule of law. It's who you know, and you have to have power figures and so on and so forth.
Yeah, unfortunately, we've actually run out of time. We'd like to thank you very much for giving us your time, Bill Nash. We really appreciate you giving
us this interview.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right. Good night.
Good Bill, night. Thank you very much for joining us at 92.5 Unity FM. That was Bill Nash, who was there in the late 40s, early 50s, during the troubled time of Israel and Palestine.
We're seconds away from the break. Joining us after the break will be Martin Summers. Please do stay tuned. Good evening. You're listening to Behind the Headlines. We're returning for the second segment. And if you join us in the first half hour, you will have heard our interview with Bill Nash, who served his national service during the British administration period of Palestine. Joining us now from Bristol City FM, presenter of the weekly Drive Time programme every Friday, 5 till 7pm. You can go to thisweek.org.uk, is old Labour economist Martin Summers. Hello, Martin.
Hi there.
How are you, Martin?
I'm okay.
And I don't know if you got a chance to catch any of the interview with Bill at all.
No, I didn't, because obviously I can't hear Birmingham. I can't hear I can't hear Unity directly, and I was just listening to the advert, so I caught what this topic was, but I haven't heard any of it. No.
Oh yes. Just in brief, basically, he was talking about his period serving in Palestine.
Yeah.
And he brought some interesting thoughts. I mean, from Bill's point of view, I mean, he really feels that. Disarming Israel would lead to an extinction, if you like, of Israel. I mean, what would you say? What would your thoughts be on that?
Well, I mean, obviously, every country has a right to defend itself in some way, but I don't think there's any danger whatsoever of Israel being disarmed at the moment. They've got the fourth largest armed forces in the world and nuclear weapons, so it's not really a prospect that's likely to be of any significance whatsoever.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I think we all understand that people are worried and concerned about their own security, and that's what often makes them behave in ways which other people find difficult to understand. But, you know, I mean, the history of Israel-Palestine is bound up with Britain's empire and so on, so we're all still in each other's pockets, aren't we, even after all these years.
Have you had a chance to see this dramatised series on Channel 4, The Promise, by Charles Martin?
Yeah, I did watch it the other day. I mean, it was a sort of Hollywood treatment, if you like, but a lot of the issues were dealt with, including Britain's role in allowing the situation to develop in the way that it did.
I thought it was very good, and it's the way it portrayed the Stern Gang, and of course the way they were. I thought that aspect of it was very good.
Well, I mean, the Israelis basically created their state through a kind of determined terrorist campaign, and in many ways you see groups like Hamas today have modelled their strategy on that of the early Zionist movement. And so, you know, what goes around comes around.
Well, I mean, if I understand it correctly, Martin, the old the Zionist movement, to begin with, it was actually a peaceful movement. What actually went wrong?
Well, I mean, I don't think it was ever entirely a peaceful movement. It's more the problem. I was going to talk about Libya, but we'll happily talk about this for the moment. The Zionist movement, very much like the Irish Republican movement, grew out of successful armed insurgency, and it has been very difficult for the Irish Republican movement to let go of that legacy of their history. And it's been similar for the Zionists. I mean, especially the hardcore right-wing Zionists, the Likudniks and the Jabotinskyites. They've always taken the view that actually violence has succeeded for us. It did work for us, and therefore we're not going to give it up as a strategy. And in a way, there was, if you like, a peaceful aspect to the movement. I mean, they basically just wanted somewhere to live and to have their own state. But they were always very clear that if violence was required, then violence would be used. But then that's not unusual. I mean, most liberation movements of any kind or political movements have some. You know, that apart from entirely pacifist movements, which are few and far between, most people do accept the legitimacy of violence. I mean, it's just part of the way the world is.
I mean, is that violence they were determined to use? Violent means if necessary. I mean, remember they go through, you know, Second World War and the Holocaust has recently happened.
Well, exactly, and of course, not all the Zionist activists in the 40s had been in Europe at the time, but nonetheless, of course, there was a huge kind of sense of insecurity in the world Jewish community as a result of what had happened, which of course gave a tremendous force to the arguments that they were making within their own community, that we have to defend ourselves because if we don't, others will abuse us, basically. And you know, they had been abused, so it was not an irrational thing to believe, was it?
Now, coming back to the present, and much of our focus is at the moment is on Libya and Colonel Gaddafi. We watched, as you may have seen on television yesterday, Gaddafi was addressing journalists, and there was, I think, three or four international journalists there. One of them was from the BBC, and they reported that they've seen, you know, him laughing and, you know, addressing and saying that his people still loved him. But when we look at other sources, the picture we see and the reports we're getting from the BBC or Al Jazeera or other media sources, they portray a different picture.
They do. I mean, obviously, it's very difficult from this distance for us to keep up with events. And I'll bet you people on the ground don't really know what's going on. They'll know what's going on near where they are, but what's happening down the road will be a mystery to them. I mean, what I was thinking of just focusing on briefly is the history of Colonel Gaddafi in Libya and the role that British and other outsiders have played in relation to him.
Yes.
This is an opportunity to just reprise some of the things that that have happened over the years. I mean, Gaddafi was came to power in 1969, and he was always, you know, semi-hostile to Western interests. And when Reagan came to power in the US, he was quite keen to set up a kind of Islamic bogey person for the West to hate. And at that stage, Gaddafi filled the bill. This is long before Osama bin Laden, long before the war in Afghanistan. So we're talking the early 80s. And one of the things that tipped the British public opinion against Libya was the killing of WPC Yvonne Fletcher outside the Libyan embassy in the 1980s. But there was a very interesting documentary made in the 1990s, and if Tony's on later, he can reference this documentary. It's a two-hour documentary on Channel 4, Dispatches documentary, which showed that, in actual fact, it probably wasn't the Libyans that had shot the police woman. They had fired over the heads of the demonstrators, but the bullet had actually come from outside the Libyan embassy because the ballistics were all wrong. And in the film, they had the SAS's ballistics expert. And I remember very well, because I watched the film at the time, saying, well, I can tell you one thing for sure, it wasn't the Libyans that killed the police lady. And in the second of the films, they showed that it was probably, that the bullet probably came, it was the same caliber as the bullet that the Libyans were using, but it came from an observation point being run by Western intelligence services. And what that implies, and what this documentary implied, was that the Libyans were foolishly using firearms to intimidate their opponents. But that the Western intelligence services had picked up on that and used the opportunity to assassinate a 19-year-old police officer, woman police officer, in order to create a bogey image for Libya. Anyway, I don't know whether that's true or not, but it was a two-hour documentary in the 1990s, which was on Channel 4, and very interesting at the time. And from that period onwards, You then got a series of problems. So there was later on, there was a bombing in a discotheque in Berlin, which was blamed on Libya, and which led to the bombing of Libya from bases here in Britain. So the US aircraft took off from Britain, flew to Libya and bombed it. They weren't allowed to fly over Spain or France. They had to fly round and through Gibraltar. But in Viktor Ostrovsky, who was a Mossad agent, he wrote in his book, his autobiography, saying that in actual fact that was all a Mossad operation. They had planted the bomb in Berlin, which killed two US Marines. They'd also sent a fake message from inside Libya, supposedly ordering the bombing. So what's really happening here in both these events is that the British public opinion and the British are being manipulated into an anti-Gaddafi frame of mind. So then, of course, what happened after the bombing was the whole relationship between Libya and Britain really deteriorated, and Gaddafi had his adopted daughter killed, and various people, various 100-some-odd people were killed in this bombing. He said to his minions, well, who's the enemies of the British? Oh, it's the Provisional IRA. So he got in touch with the Provisional IRA and said, well, would you like some weapons? And they went, yes, please. And then he supplied them with, there's no dispute about this, everybody understands this, he supplied them with 10 boatloads of the latest and most deadly weaponry. This only came to light with the seizure of the Excellent, which was the 10th boat, which was caught by accident. But then by that stage, the IRA had already taken receipt of 9 boatloads of equipment. Most of this equipment, by the way, has now been sealed into bunkers in the Irish Republic, under the supervision of the Canadian and the Finnish armies as part of the peace agreement. And in fact, the IRA was so well armed by that by the time this process had finished that they had enough weaponry to carry on fighting till doomsday, really. Most of which they never used, which is why they were more than prepared to hand it over, because it had just sat there for most of the time anyway. But of course, very significantly in these weapons supplies was Checkmate Semtex explosive, which was extremely important to their campaign. But nevertheless, I mean, they themselves will admit that that they got this stuff from the Libyans, but they would say, well, you know, you bombed Libya and killed 120 people, and they didn't like that. So this is the kind of murky waters in which we're swimming. And then, of course, the Lockerbie bombing took place sometime later.
88 I believe.
Yeah. And again, there's question marks about whether Libya were involved with that. The Megrahi appeal was about to come. Megrahi was released, in my view, because it was about to come to appeal in Scotland. And a Scottish police inspector, this is all in the Scottish press, the Glasgow Herald and so on, was going to testify that the CIA had planted the circuit board on the crime scene which implicated the Libyans. And just the final point, before I leave this topic, is the so-called Gaddafi plot, where MI5 officers David Shaler and Annie Machon, who I know, were staggered to find that MI6 were plotting to kill Gaddafi and had provided thousands of pounds worth of resources, including explosives and weaponry, to the Islamic Fighting Group of Libya to try and assassinate Gaddafi. And an assassination attempt was made, which actually ended up with the killing of a number of civilians in a bomb attack, which missed Gaddafi completely.
What would have been their motives, Martin, do you think?
Well, because Gaddafi is a kind of bogeyman, a sort of Osama bin Laden figure, to militarise Western societies. Oh, we've got some enemies, there's one. And also they want the oil. I mean, ultimately, that's what's coming on. That's going to happen now. The Western powers are looking at this, thinking, "Who's going to get hold of this oil?" But the point I'd make about the Islamic Fighting Group of Libya is that they were Al Qaeda Libya, and this is why Annie and Dave resigned from MI5, saying we're arming and training Al Qaeda here. And this is before 2001. This is before 9/11. So there's always been a kind of on-off love-hate relationship between Gaddafi and the West. Because at other times, when they failed to get rid of him, they've cozied up to him because they wanted to keep... I mean, all of these people that have just been released are working in the oil fields in Libya. They've just been rescued. And that's because they've tried to get rid of him lots of times, and when they failed to get rid of him, they've done deals with him. But he's not a very nice person. I wouldn't like him running my country. And I'm glad to say that there was a statement made by the National Libyan Council on Sunday afternoon from Benghazi. Their spokesperson, Hafiz Goga, said that the rest of Libya will be liberated by the people and Gaddafi's security forces will be eliminated by the people of Libya, and that we do not want outside intervention. And I think that's a very important thing for people to note at this moment. It looks as if the revolutionary forces in Libya, whoever they are, do not want intervention by Western powers. They don't want no-fly zones, they don't want anything like that. And I think the Western powers are offering to intervene because they want to control the outcome. Well, I think that's what people need to keep an eye on at this moment.
I mean, at the moment we do have as you say, the Western powers that be, the United States and the UK here have frozen Gaddafi's assets. Also, yesterday afternoon, the European Union actually imposed its sanctions on Libya. How do you think that would play out the Gaddafi camp?
The Gaddafi camp obviously won't like any of this. I'm more concerned about the anti-Gaddafi camp inside Libya. We don't want to do anything which will make their situation any worse. The UN Security Council passed a unanimous resolution in favour of sanctions on Libya, and that includes the Russians and the Chinese.
Yeah.
But the Russians, the Chinese and the French have already made it clear that outside intervention would not be constructive. And I think it's very silly of David Cameron to be floating the idea that we're going to send a gunboat to Libya. I think it's just not... I mean, they may be planning it. I certainly think that the US are certainly moving military assets into position so that they could intervene if they wish to do so. But since the people on the ground have said they don't want them to do that, I think that would be an extremely unwise thing for them to do.
Mm. Yes. But, I mean, we've seen how the Americans react to those situations. Clear-cut example, Iraq and Saddam Hussein. Now, if they decided to intervene in Saudi Libya, do the anti-Gaddafi camp have any way of resisting the Americans?
Well, I mean, don't forget the anti-Gaddafi camp are now armed. It looks like the army has virtually completely deserted to their camp, and it's the special forces and the mercenaries that are defending Gaddafi.
Mm.
But, I mean, it's just like anything else. I mean, war, even if you're fighting for the right things, a war is often not the right solution to a problem.
No, it's not.
I mean, imagine if you're walking as a foreign soldier, walking into a city in Libya, you don't know who's on what side. There are some people with guns who are on your side, some people with guns who are not on your side. How do you tell them apart if the locals can't?
Exactly.
And then what do? You just start shooting everybody, because you have to in order to protect your own force.
And potentially, this is what's happened so many times in the past as well.
That's precisely what's happened in Iraq. And it's also, you know, if you look at all the misery of the long intervention in Ireland that Britain was involved in, and that was a relatively small-scale thing with a relatively controllable situation, it was still very, very difficult. And in fact, you know, outsiders find it very difficult to cooperate in these kind of circumstances. And if you've got an armed opposition that already knows what it's doing, it seems much more sensible to let them get on with it, in my view.
Yes, sir.
And then hopefully, at the end of it all, they have a democratic election rather than just take over by people with guns. But you can't guarantee that.
We've got a caller on the line, Martin, here. We're just going to go to this caller. Hello?
Hello.
Good evening, caller.
Hi. Like to ask the gentleman a question. What is their priority? What is the expectation of... is it for the welfare of the Libyan people, or is it because of getting rid of Gaddafi, or is it because there's oil fields there and it's going to affect Europe and the economy of Europe?
Well, you're asking what the Western powers' motivation is, I presume.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, obviously, you pretty much nailed it already. I mean, their main motivation is those oil fields. That's been their motivation all along. It's been their motivation in trying to get rid of Gaddafi in the past, and it's their motivation in trying to do a deal with him when they decided they couldn't beat him. So that's the main concern. And I think also there is now, because they've been losing ground because of the other revolutions going on in other countries, and if they intervened militarily, The sort of more hawkish members of the US establishment think that they could reassert their control over the region instead of, you know, playing catch-up. They'd be starting to sort of take offensive manoeuvres. But I think one of the key things in this is that in Tunisia, there's been further demonstrations, and Ghannouchi, the guy who was put in power when Ben Ali was removed, has also been removed. So both in Egypt and Tunisia now, you've got a follow-on revolution to come, because all that's happened is that the figurehead has been removed, Ben Ali and Mubarak, but the structure, the system, the basic way of doing things has remained in place. And I don't think that the youth in these countries are going to be satisfied with that. They want something more dramatic. And the Americans want the revolution to stop here. They don't want it to go any further. And therefore, if they were to intervene militarily in Libya, they could kid themselves that they would start to control the situation more directly. But in Iraq itself, we were talking about Iraq earlier and the difficulty to intervention in foreign countries.
Yes.
In Iraq, scores of demonstrators were killed after Friday prayers, protesting against the new government in Iraq, and hundreds of people were arrested and tortured by the new government. And that's hardly been mentioned in our media.
No, it hasn't.
Wow, I'd heard nothing.
Well, it is there. It's not, yeah. I mean, with the internet today, you can keep up with what other people are finding out.
Yes.
You know, people are being told. I mean, people in Iraq know about it, for sure. And most of the demands in Iraq were economic demands. They were demanding water, electricity, jobs.
Mm.
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, hello. Hello, Martin?
Hello, I'm still here, yes.
Oh, yes, so you were saying about the demands of the Iraqi people.
Well, I just think that the Americans are now trying to, you know, or the Western powers are now trying to control the situation as best they can. They're obviously doing their best to, you know, salvage what they can from what they find to be a rather disturbing situation.
Yes.
You see, so I focused there on Libya. I mean, I Stop the War in London issued a statement today saying that there should be no intervention in Libya.
Mm.
The French have already said it's a non-starter. I think it's the Americans who want to do it, or some of the Americans, and that's why Cameron's decided to pipe up. I don't think it's terribly popular in Britain or the United States. The idea of another foreign invasion is not really the sort of thing that ordinary people want to hear. They want to know what's happened to their jobs, not to, are we going to invade Libya?
We've got another caller again. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
It's Talib, yeah?
Hello.
Hi, brother, you all right?
Fine.
Just a quick question.
Ask away.
Just a couple of questions, sorry. The first question is that, for example, if something happened, just say, in another country like Algeria or another oil developing country in the Middle East, and there, I was watching the news and they were saying that the barrel will go up to, you know, $200 per barrel, etc., and it would bring the whole economy of America down. And what do you think that the West is prepared to do for not that for that not to happen? What lengths are they
prepared? Yeah, carry on,
Martin. Is that the whole question, or is there?
Yes, that's the whole question. Yeah.
Well, I think they don't want the oil price to go up, but in a sense, it's almost inevitable because the turmoil itself forces the oil price up. Oil prices are not really set by supply and demand. They're set by futures markets, which depend very much on people's perceptions of the future. So if the perception of the future is that we're going to have a rocky period of political instability in the Middle East, which looks pretty clear, then the oil price will go to $200 a barrel. And Putin, the Russian prime minister, has already said it's likely to happen. But what that means in terms of domestic politics in Britain and other Western countries is that all this talk of recovery could be dead within the week. And the recovery won't be there. Not that it was anyway, but it's a very worrying for them. But I can't see that intervening militarily is going to change the situation. If they get bogged down in a big fight in Tripoli, for example, I don't think that's going to do much for the oil price.
So we could be in for a tough summer, really, you mean?
We are. This is what was going to happen anyway. What's very interesting as well, of course, is you're now starting to get demonstrations in the US itself, in Madison, Wisconsin, against the economic policies that are being pursued. And in a way, if you look at the Middle East over the last generations, it's had a miserable time, horrible dictators, outside forces telling everybody what to do, Palestinians constantly bulldozed over and nobody takes any notice. I mean, this is a moment of hope as well as a moment of sadness because of all of the bloodshed.
Absolutely. And
I think also it looks like, you know, people really are taking actions into their own hands now. It's reached a point where we could potentially see people's governments in some of these countries.
We could. I mean, that's this. I mean, and you see what's happened in Tunisia and Egypt is that because there's been a relatively peaceful movement and a relatively benign state. I mean, hundreds of people have died in Egypt, and people are still being tortured as we speak. But Libya, I think they started off trying to have protests, but that they then immediately turned into battles because of the nature of the situation, and so that's gone to full escalation very, very quickly. And I just noted something earlier from the Independent newspaper, which that since the government came to power last year, this new government, they've issued weapons licenses for tear gas for Bahrain, anti-personnel ammunition for the Libyans, so the guns, the bullets that are being fired could easily have been supplied by the British, helicopters to Algeria, and armoured personnel carriers to Saudi Arabia, and that's just since the government came to power last May.
Well, that's shocking, really, isn't it?
It is. And then Britain's main export industry is weaponry, and our main export market is the Middle East.
You can see
how bound up Britain is with all of this mess.
Well, I mean, if that's the case, Martin, how does it then bode for British and the Americans? I mean, in one hand, we're trying to, we tried back in 2003. Again, unfortunately, though we do have to go back to Iraq, we tried to disarm Saddam Hussein. And with the other hand, we're selling weapons to other dictators in that region.
Well, I mean, don't forget, the arms industry is driven by personal profit. I mean, the Vietnam War, for example, was lost by the Americans, but it wasn't lost by the American arms industry. Lockheed Martin and Boeing and all these companies made a packet out of the Vietnam War, even though America as a country lost. And I think a lot of Britain's arms sales in the Middle East are simply based on greed. If somebody's got some money and they want to buy our stuff, then we're more than willing to sell it to them. And what they do with it, we're not really bothered about.
That's the same Lockheed Martin that's actually going to be producing the UK census as well.
Well, they get everywhere, these multinational companies, don't they? They sell you ice cream and they sell you anti-personnel weapons.
Yes, that's incredible.
I mean, it's I mean, what's happening in the Middle East is exposing the economic links between us. It's exposing the military links between us, and it's reminding us what a small planet we live on.
But I mean,
coming back to what we were talking earlier with the promise and Britain's role in the Palestine problem.
Mm.
I mean, we've been in each other's pockets for many years, and. You know, we need to start talking as if we are all one big family, because we are.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk of interdependence. There's a lot of that around, and you know.
Well, we are. We're obviously interdependent on each other, aren't we? I
mean, that's something quite natural.
It's pointless to pretend otherwise. I mean, I think in previous eras of history that was less so. You know, I mean, societies were more self-contained, but that's not true anymore.
But I mean, you know, we just briefly touched on there, Martin, about the economy and how the arms industry making a packet out of selling arms to foreign countries.
Well, actually, I do apologise, but we're actually running very, very short on time. Maybe perhaps Martin could join us for a few minutes after the break, possibly?
Yes, I'll hang around after the break if you want. Yeah, that's fine.
Well, that'd be great. You are listening to Behind the Headlines. We're here every Tuesday, 8 to 10 p.m. on Unity FM. That's www.unityfm.net, and 93.5 FM if you're in the Birmingham area as well,
and some of the surrounding areas. If you want to give us a shout, 0121 772 8892, or go to our Facebook page and type in Behind the Headlines
and drop us a post.
Welcome
back to Behind the Headlines. Just like to take opportunity to thank Lucas Morris and Richie Kenningray for their contributions to the show. Fine contributions indeed. And you can find out more about Lucas on www.topdrawdigital.com. Martin is still with us.
Hello,
Martin. And just for a bit, we're discussing the continuing rise of revolution in the Middle East.
Yeah, well, it's this is not obviously the end of this. It's going to go on. Ultimately, the West is really worried. I mean, why the oil market's worried is Saudi Arabia, because they've got the biggest oil reserves. So in a way, the Bahraini struggle, which is you know, obviously less dramatic than what's going on in Libya, is potentially more strategic, because Bahrain is right next to where the Saudi oil fields are. Many of the Saudi oil workers are relatives of people in Bahrain. And of course, also Bahrain, with a majority Shia population, tends to be more sympathetic towards Iran. The US Fifth Fleet is based there, and they were preparing for some kind of assault on Iran. So Bahrain would have been a key staging post for that. So... But there's lots of other things going on. There were people killed in Oman. I mean, if you look closely, you'll see that there are fights and struggles going on right across the Middle East in places that don't actually make the major headlines.
Absolutely. And also, I think Tony's joining us very shortly. But any last pieces of news before?
Well, I think what I mentioned earlier about the Channel 4 documentaries about the murder of WPC Yvonne Fletcher.
Yes.
Tony, we used some footage from those documentaries in our show on BCFM last Friday, and you might want to ask him a bit more detail about those documentaries that were made in the 1990s, because he tracked them down and excerpted some things from them. So I think I would like to pass that ball to Tony.
Well, Martin, thank you very much as ever for joining us here on Unity FM, giving us the weekly roundup of not so much politics, but you know, the events that are currently happening around the world.
As we like to say, the subjugated news.
Absolutely.
Hopefully I'll see you next week, guys.
Yes, we do.
We look forward to that. Of course, Martin and Tony will be joining us live next week,
gentlemen. So.
For the show, so do join us. We'll also be having Steve Jolly as well joining us as well. So it's going to be a very packed show.
It will be an action-packed one. So keep your knobs cranked up to 93.5 Unity FM. And in the meantime, phone lines are open if you want to drop your comments. 0121 772 8892. Or if you want to give us a text, 07926, and yes, the text phone is working, 07926 843388.
And also, I'd just like to mention our Facebook page, which is very simple. It's Behind the Headlines. All the recent shows that we have done are available for listen again via the Mixcloud website. There's links. If you want to go straight to Mixcloud, you can go to www.mixcloud.com/Tariq Ziad, and they're up there. But it's easier for you to go to Facebook, because you can listen to them all there.
Yep, and you know,
that's Behind the Headlines.
It's fantastic, actually, because it's got pictures of lovely front pages of the newspaper. So, you know, even I couldn't miss it.
So please do leave your comments as well if you want to leave anything now or during the week. We will respond as well. So
Or if you want to make it lengthier, if you want to drop us a line, then it's behind the headlines 935@hotmail.co.uk. Behind the headlines is all one word and all in lowercase. Behind the headlines 935@hotmail.co.uk. Well, Derek, it's been a fascinating last hour, hasn't it? We talked to Bill Nash, who was in the ex-army and was in the Israel-Palestine region during the start of the trouble that we're seeing now. And
yes, of course, what I would refer to as the autonomous British rule, if you like, of occupied Palestine.
Mm.
Prior to the events of the Israeli state, in the very, very early days of the early settlers, you know, coming onto the Palestinian land. And we talked about what many people have seen already, of course, the Channel 4 documentary, The Promise, which I watched and of what I've seen so far, I enjoyed. And of course, yeah, I'm sure it's rather dramatised, but there are some also worthwhile points there from a historical point of view that are worth noting there as well.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
If you haven't seen it, give it a look. It's an interesting piece.
Just on the sidetracking from that a little bit, with the you know, current situation that obviously we've been discussing over the last half hour regarding Libya, and unfortunately, the scenes that we're watching on our television so far reported that over 1,000 people dead and just over 100,000 people are fleeing the trouble spots to actually get out of the trouble zone in Libya. Let's hope that comes to a peaceful end very, very soon. Also, one of the news we haven't really concentrated much on is the earthquake last week, Tariq, in Christchurch. We've seen it about 6 months ago. Same place was hit by a higher magnitude earthquake compared to this they were hit with last week. 6.1 to 6.5 magnitude, I believe. A couple of hundred people lost their lives. So a very, very sad story again.
Yes, of course, our condolences to, you know, those
to all the people. And some of the...
A very sad and, you know... It is very unfortunate and tragic events indeed.
Absolutely, and some of the people who had lost their lives, a few British citizens over in Christchurch who had also lost their lives. So,
well, I mean, British or New Zealand, it doesn't really matter. Ultimately,
no.
It's a loss of human life.
Absolutely.
It's a devastating thing.
And it's for such a natural disaster. I mean, they're just recovering from one less than a year to be hit with it again. It's beyond belief. So we're kind of lucky in that sense in this country, Tariq, that, you know, Allah kept us, keeping us safe from all these natural disasters.
Well, in reality, I don't think anyone is truly safe.
No, absolutely not, but, you know,
safe.
Not absolutely not, but, you know, compared to what they're putting up with at the moment, you know. We will be joined by Tony Gosling very, very shortly, and we will be talking about extradition of Julian Assange,
Bankers' profits, indeed, it's a very, very important topic. It's something we just don't talk about enough.
No, we don't. And, you know, we will also very, very soon in upcoming shows be looking at the cutbacks they'll be making in April.
Yeah, in future shows, we will have those who heard us last year in our former U Classify show may have heard the interview with Moeen Yassin and other members of the conference last year
at
the House of Lords. Well, this year they're holding a conference at the again at Westminster. It's going to be on March the 30th. They concentrate more on the Middle East and the Muslim world this time as well, in Saudi Arabia. And they will be joining us on March the 15th. We'll be giving you more details on that in our next show. That's coming up as well.
Coming up in the next couple of shows.
As we mentioned, Steve Jolly is joining us next week, and he'll be talking about a very interesting thing, something I didn't know, but it's the UK census, which is coming up soon. And
yes, I mean, I kind of found out about this a few weeks ago. They were talking about this on another BBC station, and you know, there was one of the questions on there about the religious question on there, you know, what religion are you on, things like that, which a couple of comments I heard from people was, well, why is it necessary to actually find out whether you're what religion you are or what race you are?
Well, I think this goes into the wider point of data collection in the first place, and the fact that it's almost mandatory to have your data collected and put in a database now. The government that's here now, they promised that they would get rid of ID cards, but that seems to be a bit of a swerve, because what you're finding is that there are more and more cameras appearing, there's more and more spy technology. I'm now hearing that even Facebook and Google are using face scanning technology as well.
I believe they are, yes.
And what's happening is that your information, you know, which you may believe is securely stored online, may not be so, and all of a sudden your identity is being plagiarized, it's being raped. All of a sudden you don't have the right to privacy anymore, and this is an issue.
Well, I mean, we've seen this over last year and the year before, Tarek. We discussed it on this show, which was known then by you, Classified. But we talked about hard drives going missing with millions of people's personal data. Disks are CD-ROMs being lost in the post from government departments, again, with all our data. And, you know, it makes me think that is anything that we they say that's going to be personal, confidential, with our medical records, bank records, is any of that kind of record actually safe? And over the last couple of years, with the losing of all the amount of data they have lost, it's kind of raises a doubt in my mind that, and now, as you say, Facebook, Google, and who knows, many, many other social networking sites, when they say your information will be stored in privacy, the question I ask is, would they be then? How secure are these sites?
Well, if you're a Facebook user, and I am a Facebook user, I would recommend that you set your privacy settings properly and correctly so that your information cannot be leaked out to, you know, sources you wouldn't want them leaked out to. There's also the RSS feed on Facebook is said to be very, very prone to viruses and malware as well. There's many, many issues, basically. I mean, you talk about the internet. And these days, it's a fascinating thing, but it seems that there's a new virus every single day. You've got these DDoSes, you've got clickjacking as well, which is basically clicking onto URLs and finding...
You had a recent problem, didn't you, Tarek, with the botnets?
And botnets as well is another thing, which basically... a botnet effectively makes your computer a zombie. You're linked up to a network, which is basically a set of servers full of malware, which take over your computer and use your computer as a zombie. So there's, you know, even using the internet to a certain extent now, you have to have some sort of spyware, some sort of, you know, protection on your computer. It seems that, you know, we live in very, very, as Bill said, very uncertain times. You know,
especially, as I say, with the budgeting, the budget day coming up this month, and with the cutbacks that are going to be kicking in April.
Well, you mentioned the cuts, and again, I'm going to just break it down a little bit. You know, there's going to be literally millions taken out of our local economy here in Birmingham. You can expect millions to be taken out of the care industry here, basically. It's going to leave a lot of people who are currently in care. They won't get that care anymore. They won't get the provisions that they have. They'll be left, you know, vulnerable and unprotected. Also, it's going to affect the education system. Some of the poorest, most vulnerable children in society will lose the right and the ability to a good education and to be able to progress further. The special help they used to get, they're going to cut, you know, thousands. I think, if my figure is correct, if anyone correct me on this, I think it's something like 700,000 jobs are to be axed
Birmingham,
in the next 2 or 3 years.
Birmingham need to cut, I think, if Birmingham City Council would like to phone in and give us a correct figure, but Birmingham is like to cut 2,000 jobs this year alone. Save, I think, £4 or £5 million.
Well, the Birmingham Post gave a projection saying that it's going to take 30 years to recover from this economic decline. 30 years alone. And the effects of the Midlands are going to be some of the most devastating. Of course, the Midlands was traditionally an industrial area producing cars and various other things. The loans are drying up as well. At the moment, there's a lot of protesting going on. I recommend people, if you go to a website called One Good Cut, and if you Google that and go to the website, there's a petition taking place where you can petition that the best cut that we can make is a cut to subsidise bankers who are being subsidised by the governments, you know, incredible amounts of money, which they gamble on the stock markets. One of the things they like to do is they go to these debt auctions where they go and they buy each other's debts, you know, sovereign nations, and they gamble it away. You know, they take bets on which nation will start to fail economically, and meant this as a nice little learner. At the same time, more and more jobs being lost every single day. The everyday hard-working people from the upper, lower class and middle class are, you know, they're now under a threat. The lifestyle is under threat as well. And I don't think people realise the severity of all this as well. This recession, as we're being told, it looks, you know, we're actually not in a recession, but we're actually in a depression. Rather like the depression of the 1920s. And the very frightening thing is that depressions, they tend to lead to wars. That's a very, very frightening thing as well. And the question that I don't like to ask, I don't like to be a doom monger or a harbinger of, you know, doom, but sometimes, you know, we look at the historical past of these kind of things and we ask a question, you know, are we on the brink? Are we on the precipice of another world war? I certainly hope not. And I believe joining me now is Tony Gosling. Hello, Tony. Okay, we don't seem to have Tony as yet, but we'll keep trying. Also, feel free, if you're listening, to leave comments on our Facebook page behind the headlines. Give us a call, 0121-772-8892. You can check out previous shows on that Facebook page as well. And like I say, coming up shortly will be Tony, so please do stay tuned. And as I was saying, I was talking about cuts. I was talking about cuts. And the effects that cuts are going to have on the Midlands, and they are very, very, very severe indeed.
Absolutely. I mean, not only the Midlands, though, Tarek. I mean, I think we're going to see the impact of the cutbacks they made last year, which don't kick into the academic financial year. Which,
well, there's also this welfare reform, isn't there? I mean, there's a lot of talk about this kind of like universal benefit. Now, there's going to be a lot of people claiming benefits.
Yeah.
With the high rate of unemployment, which is now soaring. It's above, you know, it's above 1 million now.
Well, I mean, they reckon by with the next few years there'll be up to or over 5 million people out of work.
Well, this is something we spoke to Tony many, many shows back, of course, about the whole concept of strategic unemployment.
And talking of strategic unemployment and Tony, he's with us right now. Good evening, Tony.
Oh, hi there, guys. Thanks for having me on again. Yeah, strategic unemployment, and actually I think a lot of this is, you know, it's not just a coincidence that more and more people are becoming unemployed. It's really a result, a sort of combined result, really, of globalisation, that is, opening up Britain to the potential, I mean, it's been shown it is, the ravages of the international market, so that, you know, we have no forms of protectionism whatsoever. I mean, this really started back in the 1980s with what was called the European Single Market Programme, which was introduced by what was then called the EEC, European Economic Community. There's something called the Single Market. Now, that single market was a European single market, but then also, of course, Europe has also really now governing the trade barriers or lack of trade barriers with other parts of the world. The idea really was to, first of all, to open up trade barriers between countries in Europe. And, you know, this word protectionism was used. But actually, it, you know, with hindsight, what's happened, as soon as we've opened our markets up to elsewhere, what seems to have happened is a lot of that capital and a lot of that wealth seems to have immediately kind of, you know, jumped on a train or a ship and disappeared out of the country. So I can't quite fathom, I don't know about you, but I can't quite fathom why this was ever considered to be something which was a good thing for Britain.
Well, I mean, I agree that it's disappeared out of the country in the sense of it's what I call the real economy. That's the economy where everyday people, they work, they go to their 9-to-5 jobs. But in terms of the other economy, which I call the private sector economy, that seems to just increase and got bigger and bigger as we've gone by as a result of this globalisation.
But it seems a lot of what people are doing today is doing things like working in financial services and insurance and things like that. And now the city is now threatening the government and saying, look, unless you really look after us, let us increase our bonuses year on year, or if we're not increasing our bonuses, increase our take-home pay year on year, or else we are also going to leave the country. And you know, it seems that is almost all that's left in Britain is a really powerful service industry.
So should we be worried about that, Tony? I mean, they make these threats, they say, look, we're going to leave the country, we'll take this economy with us, you know. Is it really such a bad thing?
Well, it is, yeah. I mean, you know, basically, if people are British residents, then they should be paying tax in Britain. They shouldn't be able to either go and spend 40 days a year or whatever it is in the Channel Islands and become foreign residents, at least for tax purposes. And they certainly shouldn't be able to put all their savings in these tax havens. That should be used to actually help get our economy going again.
I totally agree.
But this whole business of protectionism, I think it is, you know, I'm actually an internationalist. I think, you know, we need to be looking abroad and we need to have solidarity with people in other parts of the world. We need to, you know, without, you know, things like military intervention, we need to be doing what we can to actually make sure people's lives in other parts of the world are as good as they have been here, and still are, you know, to a certain extent. But I think that the idea of actually then with the government of Britain in Westminster actually having a policy which is slowly stripping away all of our manufacturing base in the country, and it's all fleeing abroad. I mean, we have here in just outside Bristol in Keynsham a Cadbury's factory, and I'm sure there's countless factories in Birmingham that have been closing over recent years. And, you know, that what's happened there is a classic case. Royal Bank of Scotland, who the British taxpayer bailed out, lent a whole load of money to Kraft Foods in the United States to buy up and close down our Cadbury's chocolate factory here.
Now, didn't the RBS was behind that? That was,
oh, yeah. And, you know, this is really the business sector taking the mickey out of the politicians. And the politicians are holding up their hands, people like Vince Coburn, saying, oh, there's nothing we can do. But, of course, there's plenty you can do as politicians. They can lay down the law in these sorts of situations, and certainly they can do something which they may then be challenged by Kraft or challenged by the Royal Bank of Scotland in the courts. But there seems to be absolutely no political will to protect British jobs and protect British industry, and that's the actual final result of what I was talking about earlier in the 1980s, which is the single market programme, which was introduced by the EEC, as it was at the time. It's now sort of transmogrified into something completely different, which is now making pronouncements, with these unelected officials making pronouncements about what should happen in Libya and what a terrible man Colonel Gaddafi is. And, you know, what we've got in the EU, in my view, is really a fake democracy. You know, you've got these MPs, and if you talk to these MPs off the record, they'll certainly, the MEPs, rather, the members of the European Parliament, they'll tell you that they don't really have any power. They spend quite a lot of time on planes, flying around, going to meetings. But when it actually comes to making decisions about new laws to come in Europe, they have very little power. It's a bit like...
Well, it's pretty pointless in the release, isn't it? I mean,
it's there as a sort of show for the cameras. And it didn't surprise me when I saw pictures of a massive collapsed part of the European Parliament building in Strasbourg last year. It's just, you know, it is a kind of fake show to put on the TV from time to time. But getting back to this single market thing from the 1980s, I actually had a look. I was handed, about 10 years ago, handed a thesis, which was done by a woman in one of the big, I think it was Columbia University in the United States. And I put this up on my Bilderberg.org website. And it's called Imagine Yourselves to Be the Dictators of Europe. This was her thesis. She wrote for politics studies and economic studies at university. And it showed that the European Single Market Programme, which was drawn up in the 80s, implemented in the 80s, was actually put together by Philips Electronics, actually at the expense of Philips Electronics. And what had happened is they got a whole bunch of academics together, and they were saying, look, we want to plan the new Europe. And these academics had come back to the European Union people and the Philips Electronics people and other business leaders and said, oh, it can't be done. And this is why I say use that phrase, because what happened is the business leaders said to these academics, imagine yourselves to be the dictators of Europe. Don't tell us it can't be done. Just write and explain how it will be done. And of course, this is over the years, is slowly what's happened is the interest of all individual countries in Europe has been thrown out the window, and what's happening now is a lot of the wealth of the country, the manufacturing base of the country, the capital wealth, is not even staying in Europe. It's going outside Britain, and I really concerned, because we've got most of our population in Britain in the cities, and raring to go, geared up for full time employment in whatever industry. Particularly in manufacturing, traditionally, and we've got lots and lots of empty office space. I mean, here in Bristol, I did a survey last year and found around about a half of the offices in a particular part of our city, in the city centre, were actually empty. And many of them, for example, will have the bottom two floors, or the bottom floor is being used. But if you go back on the other side of the road and look up, you can see, or if you go inside the building and go up the stairs, you'll see that many of the top floors of these buildings are actually empty. And I'm really bothered about whether there are ever going to be enough jobs in this country in the future for the people in our cities. And we need to think, I think, about, you know, what is post economic crash Britain going to look like? Because it's clear now that we're in a double dip recession. I mean, because of George Osborne's policies in cutting back now, what's happened is that the very, very slight recovery that we had in the middle and end of last year is now turning back into recession. There's negative growth, so the economy is now shrinking again. There's a lot of work to do in order to actually get the economy going again. And, of course, all this means more and more unemployment, as you were saying earlier on. And I was listening to that, sort of biting my nails, thinking, what on earth are we going to do this about this? This is the main, should be the main concern of government at the moment, is making sure that there are jobs for our young people and jobs for unemployed people in the future. And it seems to be actually the last thing they're thinking about. I always get worried when people like David Cameron start talking about intervention in places like Libya, because I know this is a normal thing that governments do. When they're having really big problems at home, they start pointing abroad and pointing the finger. I think what David Cameron needs to do is go and have a good look in the mirror.
But isn't that the tactical way of keeping, I mean, as you say, we're in a double dip recession in this country, Tony, and David Cameron then, you know, points a finger at Libya and say, hey, there's a good option to, grab a bit of a few brownie points. Isn't that another way, though, again, to actually keep attention of himself and
deflecting,
the current crisis,
so to speak,
and what's going on back home?
Yeah, I think you're right. The other thing, I really want to have a moan right now about the BBC, because this morning on their news bulletins on Radio 4 and Radio 5, who were they quoting? Former Prime Minister John Major thinks it would be a good idea to have military intervention in Libya. Now, just a minute, BBC. This guy is not just the former Prime Minister John Major. He's also the former chairman. In fact, he's more recently, he could more rightly be described as the former European chairman of the Carlyle Group, which is a massive investment bank. You remember these investment banks, which are actually responsible for this financial crisis? John Major was the chair of one of these. And the Carlyle Group, which Major used to chair up until fairly recently, it spends most of its money investing in arms companies.
We're going to have to stop you there, Tony. Keep hold of that thought, and we'll return to this after the break. You're listening behind the headlines on 93.5 Unity FM, Birmingham and the surrounding areas. Welcome back. It's just after half past nine. You're listening to 93.5 Unity FM, Birmingham and the surrounding areas. This is, of course, Behind the Headlines. Today, March the 1st, 2011, with myself, Tariq Saeed Ahmed, and Tariq, I'm sorry, he's Tariq. Last half hour of the show to go. It's been a fascinating hour and a half. We're going to be in conversation with Tony Gosling from BCFM, who is our regular guest, and we are talking about the economy, and we're going to return to that subject now. Welcome back, Tony.
Hi there, guys.
You were just saying before break about the decline of the economy and about the jobs.
Well, yes, what we're lacking right now is any kind of sense of vision for the future for Britain from the present government. And I have to say, you know, also the previous New Labour government. I think we had a great big hole where the vision should be. But personally, I think we have to be quite self-critical as a nation at the moment, and we have to look at the fact that we've been, sort of living on our empire and the vestiges of empire for many, many decades, and that has to change. We've got to think, well, hang on a minute, we're on an equal footing with the rest of the world now, and we need to restructure our economy, in fact the entire country, appropriately, so that, for one thing, for example, I think we should be having priorities like Britain being self-sufficient in food. We've got some of the best farming land in the country, in the world, here in Britain. And, you know, from everything from the sort of uplands, the sort of sheep farming land in the mountainous parts of the country, as well as the, the very, very good arable land in the lowlands. And but we import a tremendous amount of our food, and we don't export hardly any food. So what are we doing? You know, if there is any problem with getting food around the world, the oil starts running out, it starts to become incredibly expensive to transport food around the world, and we're in a really difficult situation. The other thing, of course, is we've got our very, very powerful handful of supermarkets that, well, whilst they will compete a little bit in price, essentially they're just a small club of people who are all making a tremendous amount of money being the middlemen between us and the farmers and the food producers. And so I think a combined, you know, one thing I would see would be really positive for the future is a combination of government policies to bring, you know, a land back into production to actually produce as much food as we can from here within Britain as a strategic plan to do that, as well as a way of either breaking up some of these big supermarkets like Tesco's into, you know, several smaller different groups, and breaking up these big companies who have become much, much too powerful and are now going around the country acting like bully boys, basically, you know, spending fantastic amounts of money on legal fees to cower local authorities and force them into taking their supermarkets. And another thing, I think, you know, actually we should see some nationalisation. That is, the national governments taking over certain industries which have become way too powerful. Things like the gas, British gas, the national grid, our electricity distribution, and these electricity companies. I think all of them should actually be taken back into public ownership. And I know what many of your listeners are thinking, and I'm sure you're thinking too, is where are we going to find the money to do that? Well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? We have a massive stake in these banks. These banks have got the money to lend to big companies like Kraft to take over Cadbury's. Then I'm sure that they've got enough money to lend to the government.
Well, exactly.
In fact,
yeah.
The government really should be thinking about using some of its, you know, this quantitative easing money, where it's printing money and
QE,
and that money is then going to the banks. It should be thinking about spending some of that directly into the economy by using it in the treasury and spending it to actually reacquire large parts of British industry, which have turned into these monopolies. You know, one of the things which actually sparked the old civil war back 350 years ago in Britain was the widespread corruption and monopolistic practices. And we're seeing the same sort of thing today in far too many of these what were previously nationalised industries. After they've been privatised, what happens is these big companies like the transport companies, I mean, here in Bristol, for example, I'm not so sure what the situation is in Birmingham, we only really have one big bus company, and so they charge whatever fares they want to charge. These things all need to be taken back, I think, into public ownership and run for the benefit of the people. I've absolutely no problem with private control and private ownership of you know, specialist companies. And I think it's important that there is a sort of entrepreneur spirit so that people go out there and innovate, and that they can then reap the rewards when those innovations are successful and make money themselves, rather than having those patents nicked from them by a, you know, a bureaucratic government. But you know, this is the sort of thing I think we need to be thinking about, is that how are we going to go from Britain is going to have to be, I think, a post-industrial economy, and it may be one of the first proper post-industrial economies in the world, which means that we're going to have to start thinking about, you know, actually people moving out from the cities and into the countryside and having, I think, a much more relaxed lifestyle.
Indeed, and we've just got a caller.
More time to themselves.
Just got a caller here.
Hiya, Tony. Just a quick question for you, buddy. I was reading my local newspaper. I live in Sandwell area in Birmingham, in the Black Country, and how Salco, a company which has taken over the council from doing our dustbins. And I watched another program, it was on the news, the 10 o'clock news live on Channel 4, it's a new comedy program. I was watching on there that this company has not only taken over the council's job, but also is taking over the nuclear weapons, looking after the nuclear weapons.
Ah, this is Serco, yes, not Salco, Serco.
Yes.
Not Salco, sorry. Serco,
yes.
Yeah. Mm. And, I mean, what's your views on that? I mean, everything is run by one company.
It's a huge company.
It is. We actually did a piece on that last year, didn't we, Tariq?
That's right.
On Serco and the things they deal with.
But let's get Tony's thoughts. I mean, Talib's asked a question.
Well, Serco is actually just one of these massive sort of mega companies that have started to take on a lot of the work that the government used to do. Now, I've absolutely had enough of this. As far as I'm concerned, that these companies, first of all, they take a massive cut for themselves, for their shareholders, out of the money which is going from the government into that service. The other thing, of course, is that they also have, all of these companies have gaggles of fat cat bosses that pay themselves six or even seven figure salaries. You know, basically what they're doing is they're extracting a kind of protection money from in between where the government gives them the money which is going through taxation. There's a kind of cut which is taken by these businesses, and in every single case, the actual end result is that we end up, when these things are privatized, with a worse service, because we've got shareholders who are taking whatever it is percent every year out of that company, and so therefore there's less able to deliver a service, and then you've got the bosses too. So how anyone can make an economic argument for these companies being better than the previous situation, I think it's actually just propaganda and strong arm tactics, which has allowed these companies to get into the position where they are now. That's only one of the companies. We've also Serco. We've also got big companies like Carillion and Capita, and they're very unkindly called in Private Eye a word, which I shouldn't say now. If you want to get a copy of Private Eye, they're in there almost every week.
Great magazine, or great little newsletter. Yeah. I always read it.
Yeah, it's every 2 weeks Private Eye comes out. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, so it's an absolute disaster that these companies have now got a stranglehold on our public services, and it doesn't surprise me at all when I see so many jobs going in local authorities like Birmingham, because what's happening is these companies are actually taking over control of the country. The biggest decisions are being made are about where resources go in these enormous corporations, and our local authorities seem to be spending most of their time acting as reacting, I shouldn't say acting, they're reacting to cuts. They're actually just managing a debt that a lot of these councillors are getting very disillusioned, you know, people we elect nowadays, because they find most of what they're doing is just trying to plug the holes in the dike as the water leaks out. I mean, that water, of course, being our wealth.
Tony, you mentioned Private Eye magazine, so you must have read, of course, about the whole thing with Vodafone and where they're bullying the inland revenue, and they're winning as well.
Well, yeah, this is what's going on, essentially, is a tug of war between big corporations and our elected officials. And it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, we've had this big thing last year about the expenses crisis with the MPs, but the actual expenses involved are like a little ant in compared to the elephant of the expenses and bonuses.
Well, these are huge tax havens. They've all got big offshore accounts, and, you know, they take away millions, if not billions of pounds of tax away from the UK every single year.
As I was talking about John Major earlier on, his chairmanship of the European arm of the Carlyle Group, this massive investment bank which invests in arms, and him saying, oh, wouldn't it be a wonderful idea for us to go into Libya? I mean, obviously looking at his former employers, Carlyle Group's interests there, I mean, you know, this is the revolving door syndrome, where what happens is you've got individuals who are in government for a while, they get to learn the ropes, and then they sell out. They sell their souls to a big corporation, and even whilst they're in government, they may even be given offers of work in a big corporation if they do X and Y whilst they're in government. So what's happening is we're allowing the entire political class to be corrupted by, you know, and you actually have to be, as a politician, you'd have to be quite strong to resist the temptation to sell out when you see so many politicians like John Major who've done this before you.
Well, Tony, I mean, what's Peter Mandelson doing right now? I mean, I think he's got...
Who's taking the people seriously nowadays?
Yeah, sorry, you talk about obviously politicians taking up, you know, jobs for big corporations. I think Peter Mandelson has done something very similar recently, hasn't he?
Yes, I haven't actually been following that, but I mean, it happens all the time, I'm afraid, now, and more and more. And even if the politicians aren't going into a corporation, they often end up working for a foundation, one of these tax-free foundations, which is like a kind of a think tank, and they churn out all sorts of ideas about what privatisation is wonderful.
Consultancy firms?
I don't know if you're familiar with the website spinwatch.org. Spinwatch looks at a lot of these... I mean, I think actually for journalists, it's one of the most fascinating, brilliant pieces of academic research which is going on in the country right now.
Yes.
And it's and what they do is they look into the background of many of these foundations and many of the ideas that are coming into government policy and political policy in all the major parties actually come from these think tanks. And you'll find very often that the director of a think tank has also been the director of, say, for example, an arms company or whatever. And sometimes then they go from think tanks to be politicians too. So there's this whole culture of a kind of gravy train of moving from one minute in politics, another minute in industry. And what happens is, of course, with all of that, is the actual interests of ordinary people in the country don't even get a look in.
Also, you mentioned about big corporations, and one of the biggest corporations we have in the country, of course, are gas companies. They make a fortune out of the UK.
Well, I mean, this is a natural resource which is under the North Sea still, just, and in other parts of Europe, which is shipped around. And it actually comes out of the ground. It costs a lot of money to actually get the pipe down. But, you know, essentially it's a free gift to mankind, which is under the ground, which needs a little pipe to bring it into your house. Now, what's going on now is, even though wholesale prices in gas over the last few months have been going down, so the gas price hasn't gone down. So it's like we're on, basically, I actually think we're almost like, they are taking the mickey now out of us, and it's almost like we're kind of rats in a cage, where this is a ratcheted system, where every time there's an excuse to put up the price is put up, and yet when it comes to putting the price down again, the directors and their officials and their accountants just look the other way. All they're interested in is profits for themselves, so they can pay themselves bigger salaries, buy themselves bigger cars, and pay their shareholders more. They're not interested in the customers, and there's actually very little incentive or motive for them, apart from possibly being ashamed by the press. But in our press is in such a state nowadays that we're not doing the kind of investigative documentaries that Martin was talking about, half an hour or so ago, which looked into the murder of PC Yvonne Fletcher back in the 1980s.
No, not at all.
And that documentary, by the way, was called Murder in St. James.
Murder in St. James.
And it was a two-part dispatches. I've had a look at some of it on YouTube. The whole of the first episode is actually available online of the two. And it shows the ballistics experts from the British Army showing the trajectory of the bullet through Yvonne Fletcher's body at a very high angle. And it shows, it proves, beyond any shadow of a doubt, I mean, if you see the documentary, then you'll understand that there's no way that that bullet can have come from the Libyan embassy, and yet, immediately, it was assumed. I mean, the idea is, of course, that this was to be blamed on the Libyans, because the British and the Americans wanted to get the Libyans, because they weren't playing ball. You know, we've got an independent-minded Gaddafi running things back in the 80s, as he's very independent-minded still. And they wanted him to cooperate, and he wouldn't. So what happened was they wanted to actually put sanctions on the Libyan regime in the 80s. And what happened after Yvonne Fletcher's death was actually this was all blamed on the Libyans. And within a few weeks, the British and the Americans had managed to get the United Nations to agree to putting sanctions on Libya. So you can see that even though there's a bit of smoke and mirrors and sleight of hand going on there, what was actually happening was, this was a way of blackening the name of Gaddafi in Libya at the time. Now, I'm no big fan of him now. But I can see that going back to what I was saying about John Major calling for, military intervention in Libya, he's basically saying, look, if we can go and invade another country, then my former employers will make a packet. And yet the BBC simply roll him out on a news bulletin as a former prime minister. I mean, I think this is an absolutely appalling bit of journalism. And the fact that he's got such a massive financial motive, former employers, to go and say these things, and that the BBC don't even explain it to the listeners that this guy is involved in this massive arms industry investment bank.
Going back to the economy, Tony, as well, I mean, another issue that we haven't really touched on today is the issue, of course, is the housing bubble. Of course, now that housing bubble has burst and stock is very, very expensive now, most people cannot afford to buy a house. More and more people will be going into, repossession, and there'll be many, many more people looking for council housing or housing association housing, and this must inevitably lead to an increase in homelessness in the UK.
Well, it is. I work to do some legal advice here for squatters in Bristol, people who've just sort of moving into empty houses to make sure they've got a roof over their head. And, we're seeing quite an increase in the number of people who are coming to us, desperately needing somewhere to live. many of them ex-forces, and many of them more, and this is something I've noticed over the last year or so, also women needing somewhere to live. Because
these are former soldiers, Tony.
Sorry?
These are former soldiers.
Some of them are former soldiers, yes, who've come out of the army and then found that they just haven't got enough money or haven't got anywhere to live.
That's incredible.
So, you know, we've been trying to help... we have been helping house them. And, you know, this is really the thin end of the wedge here, because I think most people consider that their home is the most important thing in their lives. And one of the first things that this new government did was they announced that if you started to earn more than a certain amount of money, that actually you would be evicted from your home if you had a housing association or council house. Now, this doesn't give people a motive to actually get a job if they are unemployed or if they are sick or if they are a single mum or whatever. So it's taking away their motive to get a job, which seems absolutely crazy. But secondly, what people want is they want security of tenure. People want to actually have a permanent place to live. They don't want to have letters coming through the door saying, sorry, you've got to move out next week. So what on earth is this government doing? What they're doing, I'll tell you what they're doing, is they're undermining some of the very fundamental necessities of life, and they're actually taking away some of our fundamental human rights. It actually says in the United Nations Charter signed after the Second World War that everybody has a right to somewhere to live. And what they're doing there is they're trying to take away that right. And they're saying, no, you're going to actually be evicted. I think evictions are one of the most brutal things. I don't know if you've ever witnessed one. But to see someone torn out of their home, to have all their possessions thrown out onto the street, and then the place boarded up.
It's totally inhumane.
And in fact, quite often, one of the things we find in the squatting world is that property is then often left, just boarded up and left empty. Is one of the most harrowing things to see on this planet. And if the government can't actually concentrate on some of the more important, essential things in society, like making sure people have got food, water, and a roof over their head, then I don't think that government's worth voting for. And maybe that's one of the reasons people feel so disillusioned that there isn't a party around at the moment that they want to vote for.
Indeed, it's absolutely true. We just come into the last 5 minutes. I thought we could touch on Julian Assange.
Another big story, actually. It's been
back in the news again now because of his extradition.
Well, the obvious thing to talk about here is what on earth is Britain doing? Because Boris Berezovsky, who's the Russian oligarch who's now living in London with his former Israeli army guards around his house, Berezovsky is implicated very strongly, and there is enough evidence to bring him to trial in Russia in the Russian apartment bombings of 1999. So basically, he's a very strong terror suspect, and yet the British don't want to extradite, the British courts will not extradite Berezovsky back to Russia to face these charges of terrorism. And yet Julian Assange is being accused of, although it's an accusation of rape, it certainly looks as if there's been collusion between the witnesses and there are other problems. I'm not even sure if he's been officially charged over in Sweden. So it seems that British justice has kind of gone awry, and that we seem to, in this country now, at least in the highest areas of justice, we seem to have got everything upside down, that right is wrong and wrong is right. So if Berezovsky, who should be extradited as a terrorist back to Russia, is not being extradited, and yet Assange, who is actually a hero, he's one of the most important publishers in the world right now, of freedom of speech, is being extradited. And
well, isn't that the whole point, though, Tony, that because he's one of the, he's hero worshipped by millions of people around the world because of his publishing, isn't that why he's our enemy, because he's letting too many cats out of the bag?
Well, I mean, isn't that what the free world is supposed to do? We always criticise China for their lack of free speech and lack of freedom of the press in China, and their absolutely obsessive secrecy with blocking with a giant firewall all around China so the people in China can't learn what's going on in other parts of the world. One thing that's been blocking, by the way, is all the news about what's been going on in the Middle East, so the Chinese people haven't been hearing about that. This is the sort of thing that we would expect to happen in China. What I want is, if there are state secrets which don't really damage national security. And I think it's fair to say that the if not all of the leaks which came out in these recent WikiLeaks cable leaks weren't damaging to national security. They were damaging to the national embarrassment, and it shows up what these kind of officials that we've got in the Foreign Office in this country and elsewhere around the world,
very childish people,
what sort of stuff they're doing behind our backs. Mm-hmm. and the way that they're misrepresenting the view of the people. They're not in the least bit interested in democracy, and I think the secrecy actually encourages them to get up to all sorts of dirty tricks and black operations which otherwise they shouldn't and wouldn't be able to get away with. So in my mind, I mean, Assange isn't a superhero, but he's a very, very important publisher. He's a, you know, he's the next generation, really. He's taking over from where a lot of the things like the Dispatches programs of the 1980s, these really powerful investigative documentaries, used to do. Mm. Now Assange is doing this kind of thing, and he's just being victimized for it, which is a great shame.
Kind of a lost hope for, you know, real journalism.
But I don't think it is.
The WikiLeaks is not the only site like that out there. There are quite a lot of other ones, even though they don't get the publicity that Assange has got. And let's not forget, there are questions over the funding of WikiLeaks. A lot of that apparently coming from George Soros and also potentially from intelligence services of different countries who are paying Assange to basically to redact part of his... So, I mean, you know, there are criticisms, legitimate criticisms of what Assange has been up to, but ultimately, the principle of what he's doing is very important. Mm. Another site called OpenLeaks, which has also started up recently, doing a similar job to WikiLeaks, which is great. You know, all you have to do is drag and drop your, whatever it is, your thing that was a state secret into the box, and it's published, which is fantastic. That's the way things should be. If the government can't keep its... classified information classified and secret, and if it can't trust its employees, then WikiLeaks deserves to be one of the most visited websites in the world.
Well, Tony, as ever, time is our only enemy, as I keep saying. I should have this recorded actually, so I can play it at the end of every show. Tell us what's coming up in BCFM this week's Drive Time Show.
I imagine we will be looking at some of the big stories around the Middle East and North Africa. I mean, for example, looking at the US, Hillary Clinton has made it very clear that the option is open for military intervention in Libya, even though the Libyan revolutionaries, if you want to call them that, have made it absolutely clear they don't want any foreign intervention. Well, Hillary doesn't seem to worry about that. If there's any chance for her to get involved, she will. So she has ordered the American warships to move closer to Libya. So, you know, the US have got a fifth fleet in the Gulf.
Fantastic.
And they've got a sixth fleet in the Mediterranean. So both sides, really, of Libya, you know, the sort of eastern side with the fifth fleet and the northern side with the sixth fleet. And the sixth fleet has been, you know, sort of moving much closer to the Libyan coast. And they're ready to go. And, of course, all these warships, many of them anyway, have marines on board, can just sort of leap off the ship, if necessary, by helicopter, can drop down. So this is a threat to, direct threat to Gaddafi. The other thing is that the Saudis have been sending additional tanks into Bahrain. So I imagine we'll be dealing with some of these things and looking at the way that this whole explosion in the Middle East and in North Africa is likely to develop.
Well, thanks very much, Tony. We're 10 seconds away from the break, and Tony will be joining us live next week, and Martin Summer, so do tune in for that, 8 till 10 next Tuesday, Behind the Headlines.